You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 17th of August, 2022. I have remodeled my Patreon page in a few areas, and I've added an article about the situation in Cambodia. It's, you know, 10 pages, which is probably as brief as I can write anything. And I'm going to have the link right here in the description if you haven't signed up already. Consider it a place where you can hear ideas first before everyone else grabs them and mangles them. Though, if anything, that's what you should sign up for. It was just, you know, a couple of weeks ago that we celebrated not only the Feast of St. Vladimir, but also the baptism of Russia in 988. And in certain factions in Russian press, you'll hear the myth, and this entire movement is based on myth, that this was done through fire and sword. Somehow, the theology that makes slaves of everybody also makes them enslavers. They're either exceptionally weak or exceptionally strong. They haven't been able to figure out which accusation is going to stick. And this really comes from neo-pagan movement. When I say neo-pagan, I'm talking about the New Age in general. The problem is, when you go to these Protestant patriots, you know, talking to them about the New Age, you might as well talk to them about dialectics. It is, you know, presupposition and without a shred of understanding. The one exception to that has always been the great Tex Mars, who died a few years ago. He was an exception, but in general, it's a disaster. But it's easy to see why, though. It's not like there's a single sect here. It's not like there's a church. It's not like they have a temple in Jerusalem or something. There is not. This is an amorphous group of people. It's a phenomenon where there's many sects and organizations. The Russian book by A.L. Dvorkin, as far as I know, it's not in English, and he has a whole section on sectology, as he calls it. But this neo-pagan movement, New Age, whatever you want to call it, seems to be based on these very loosely formulated ideological slivers. And it came coming into prominence only in during the Vietnam War on the West Coast. But it also is a social-cultural phenomenon. The probably even more useful way to consider it, it's the basis of the postmodern, post-Christian civilization, such as it is. Now, that second sense of the concept, that's one thing they all have in common. Trying to find things that they have in common is not very easy. But building a post-Christian civilization is certainly one, and the evolutionary doctrine is certainly the other. There is not a single neo-pagan or New Age group that doesn't use the concept of the metaphors of evolution constantly. And the problem with this, you know, as I said when I was critiquing all the pagan criticisms of the alleged similarities with the New Testament, the pagan world, you know, that's become accepted because no one wants to actually look it up. I have an entire, several years ago, I had a lecture on that where I go through all of them, and all you have to do is read the original, what's left of the original stories, which always changed anyway. in the pagan world. And again, even the word pagan has no clear-cut definition. I've never heard of a heretic in the New Age consciousness. But we can call it this conglomeration of spiritualists and occultist groups, these schools, these sects, these teachings, seemingly aimed at the upper middle classes. But in terms of rigid organization, well, there may be a few. I mean, the Moonies, the Scientologists, they'll never say that they belong to any kind of a New Age cult or neo-pagan cult. And, you know, a third thing they may have in common is that these groups seek the huge potential for achieving world harmony, improving society, achieving human happiness, self-realization, inner peace, all of these empty slogans. Everything from, you know, Jay Lovelock's Gaia, Mother Earth, the inevitability of the death of the male aggressive religiosity, which of course just means Christianity. And there is a pseudo-spiritual element here. So one of the tenets, again, the fourth thing they all have in common, is a belief that modern humanity is living in a transitional period. The age of Pisces, which of course the age of the fish, the age of Christ, gives way to, as you all know, the age of Aquarius. Liquid and watery on the one hand, Aquarius being shiny and metallic on the other hand. Now, how this comes, how this will be expressed, there's no consensus. But how many upper middle class people have the time to worry about details? See how quickly yoga took over. People not having a clue. How often, how many times a day do you hear the word karma? Again, I have an essay on that. I have, you know, the people who use it have no idea what they're talking about or where it comes from. It's become almost an English word. So it's a social fantasy, as Dvorkin said. Matthew Fox wrote the New Age Manifesto of Global Civilization, which is, you know, very similar to the Communist Manifesto. They see the reign of paradise on this planet as a result of a revolution. They claim it's only in the realm of the spirit. I'm not really sure where they think the spirit came from, that they're going to create a world in one form or another of harmony, perfect freedom, and perfect equality. And you have people like E. Rorich in pre-revolutionary Russia. In his book, The Fundamentals of the Worldview of the New Era, Klizovsky, which is a student of Rorich's, says, "The replacement of an obsolete civilization with a new one should be regarded as a normal phenomenon arising from the basic laws of evolution. Of course, such replacements do not pass painlessly and are accompanied by suffering for humanity, but the main cause of this suffering is not the change itself, which is inevitable, but the ignorance of the laws of evolution." Rorich himself wrote a letter to the Bolsheviks called The Message of the Mahatmas. He says, "In the Himalayas, we know what you are doing." This is directly to the Bolshevik party. "You've abolished the church, become a hotbed of lies and superstition. You've destroyed Philistinism. You've destroyed the prison of education, the family of hypocrisy. You burned an army of slaves. You closed the gates of the night dens. You've delivered the earth from the money traders. Can you imagine? You acknowledge that religion is a doctrine of all-embracing matter. You recognize the nullity of personal property. You figured out the evolution of community. You have indicated the purpose of knowledge. You brought all the power of the cosmos to the children. You opened the windows of the palaces. We stopped the uprising in India when it was premature. We also recognize the timelessness and timeliness of your movement, and send all of our help asserting the unity of Asia. We know many constructions will be completed in the years 28, 31, 36. Greetings to you who seek the common good. Rorich also handed over to Chacharin, on behalf of the same Mahatmas, a casket with Himalayan soil sacred to Indians to be placed on the grave of our brother Mahatma Lenin." So that gives... And that was truncated. It was a much longer quote than that, of one of the early 20th century founders of that movement, had to say. People forget just the love affair that Western liberals and leftists had with the Soviet Union in the 20s and 30s, all the way up till to the 70s, that this was a fashionable thing to believe in. Now, of course, they pretend like it never happened. But the New Agers, of course, who view this theory, not just of Vladimir, but of any Christianization, that somehow it was done through fire and sword, but use Muslims sparingly, because Islam and the popular conception of Judaism are very similar. Now, they even have their hadith of the Talmud. No question, as I've argued many times before, that there is a Jewish root. You know, Jewish on the one hand, Nestorian on the other, root of Islam. They, of course, did spread through fire and sword. But I want to focus right now just on one thing. The one neo-pagan myth I didn't deal with years ago was that of the baptism of Rus. Again, the anniversary of which was just a few weeks ago. So I've read in English publications as well as Russian publications the theory that the Christianization of Russia, the baptism of Russia, was accompanied by a genocide of unprecedented proportions. There's a film, a popular pagan film, in Russian that makes the claim, and it's a very common claim, and it's, quote, over 12 years of Christianization, only in the Kiev region, Kiev and Rus, out of 12 million people, 9 million were physically destroyed. Now, Johnson's Law being what it is, if you have a media megaphone to begin with, and you keep repeating this stuff, people will shut off whatever critical faculty they have and accept this over. It's in the air. It's something that everyone knows. It becomes a proverbial wisdom. And the 9 million fits with the 6 million Jews. And the Jews are at the core of all of this. And the problem with the Jews, though, especially in this era, the 10th century in Russia, is that because they're fairly small in number, they have to use subterfuge. Everything is based on cohesiveness and secrecy. So they have to use other groups, and they have to help build, or at least not stand in the way of, these general New Age movements that we talk about all the time. What always struck me when it comes to things like 9/11, war on terror, all this kind of thing, the color revolutions, vote fraud, people just seem to be either be afraid to use their critical faculty or don't know how. Remember, we're not born knowing logic. Yes, logic is a part of the natural order, but we have to be raised in it. We have to be raised to respect it. And the critical faculty, which we use every day of our lives, is very foreign to the typical American who is stuck at a dead-end job with more problems than they can handle, drugs and alcohol, in a dying society. They can't afford anything, believing that, you know, material wealth is the root to happiness. These are the people who simply don't have to or would rather not use their critical faculty. How can anyone accept the 9/11 story? I mean, you have to be a moron at this point. But it's easy. Everyone knows, quote unquote. Media consensus is mistaken for popular consensus. And it's just not worth it. And if you don't use your critical faculty for a while, it's going to atrophy. And it's getting harder and harder, especially since you're suffering consequences for it. And I think the final thing that these different groups have in common is the purge. That once they reach a certain critical mass in money, in size, in influence, they no longer have to worry about their opposition. They could simply ban it and destroy it. Remember, the left in the 1990s was condemning any attempt to ban pornography, to ban, the National Endowment for the Arts nonsense, and were screaming it and screaming it. Every university, I was in college at the time, And now, of course, they're at the forefront of banning anything, no matter who they are or how they express themselves, that opposes this general agenda and that we're talking about. So you hear this figure, 12 million people living in Kyiv, and he's saying it's just in the Kyiv region, 9 million were killed. Where does this data come from? What historical sources can this possibly be based on? Is that huge number of people, 12 million population, was that even possible at the time in the Kyiv region alone? And as Father George Maximov said in a great article in 2015, and I'm quoting here, the ideologists of neo-paganism know that their target audience will not ask such boring questions and trustfully swallow any fiction. And the more delusional the fiction, the more trusting they become. You hear these kind of arguments and hear these kind of theories thrown around all the time. Journalists, you know, who are there to tell a story, not to tell the truth, love these huge numbers. We've just discovered that 9 billion people were killed because of anti-Semitism or something like that. And he's right. The more outrageous the claim, the more it's believed, because no mainstream person would ever put their reputation on the line. Because they don't have access, they live in a censored bubble, they have no idea that there is another side, and that's getting worse and worse as time goes on. But even the question, was this even possible? And the first question is, how many soldiers did St. Vladimir have at his disposal? This is the Middle Ages. You didn't have a state then. You didn't have any centralized institutions at the time. Zero. His bodyguard was about 400. Now, if you were to mobilize, if you had the influence you had over the nobility, if you mobilize in time of emergency, his top number would be 40,000. And remember, these people who he would be mobilizing were pagans yesterday. And of course, they're going to have relatives and friends and associates in the Kievan areas that are still that way. So how can they possibly be used here? Baptism by force is invalid. It's rarely done. Remember, when someone says these people didn't choose baptism or they were baptized forcibly, it's imposing the modern idea of choice in these matters to the Middle Ages, which of course didn't exist. People follow the religion of their rulers. There was no question of you know, equality or choices or anything else. That just wasn't done. And it was, of course, a stupid idea. Because how, you know, can the average person even begin to talk about the soul or what the truth of the creation of the universe is? They're in no position to do that. And so they pick the one that sounds best, or they don't pick at all. Well, the question here is, let's say he could mobilize 20,000 people, 400 of whom were, you know, many of whom were recent Christians, but we know 400 absolutely were. Were they forcing their friends and relatives to be baptized? And didn't they rebel at the idea of baptism to begin with, when they were sent to allegedly exterminate all of their friends? But even if you have the high number of 40,000 Slavic soldiers, let's say they were so obedient that they were going to destroy anyone who opposed the Byzantine and Bulgarian faith unquestioningly. How in heaven's name, in a very short period of time, did they kill 9 million pagans, or 2 million, or 1 million, or 100,000? You see, amateur historiography, one of the ways you could identify it is that they're anachronistic. They take the power of the current regime, whether it be the state or corporate centralization, banks, and impose it to times where they couldn't possibly have anything like that. We're talking about swords, daggers, bow and arrow. We're not talking about machine guns and poison gas. There are no weapons of mass destruction at the time. So that means each person had to have been killed manually, as Father George said. And if there's 9 million pagans, this is becoming a sacred number with just as much symbolism as 6 million, Remember, you didn't have a state. Adult males all had the same swords and bows at home. I mean, you know, Father George says, what kind of vegetables do you have to be in order to allow yourself and your family to be exterminated with more than 40 times superiority? And of course, the neo-pagans have to say, oh yeah, our ancestors were like that. Somehow, though, that's what their native faith, as they call it, made them. Now, Christians and Orthodox say, of course, overwhelmingly, people gladly followed the religion of their rulers, and that they converted en masse, trusting in the choice of the prince, who, of course, would coordinate his action, his agenda, with the church on the one hand and nobles on the other. He couldn't do anything without the noble families. These weren't, you know, these were war bands, not a state. Of course, the New Age said that they didn't want to be baptized, but a handful of Christians somehow, at the order of a prince, forced them. And then at the same time exterminated them anyway. And which one of those, as Father George said, which one of those humiliates the ancient Russians? Can you imagine being one of these people, these weak-willed, downtrodden weaklings, or a free people going to baptism? Well, you do have some of the neo-pagans on the nationalist movement, but for the most part, they're confined on the left. The other concept is, it's common to hear Nietzsche quoted here. And Nietzsche himself said, talking about the present Lutheran Church, that the turn the other cheek doctrine, etc., turns you into weaklings. And yet they'll turn around and condemn the empire that this very same faith helped create. But if even what they're saying is true in Kiev, wouldn't Christianity then make Vladimir's people superheroes? Super powerful. I mean, the pagans say that Christianity is a religion of weakling, and that paganism makes us stronger, and it was a masculine, powerful religion, especially in Northern Europe. Well, clearly not. And what were the Slavs? This is something even the great Saint Hilarion, who wrote on Law and Grace, right, during this very same period of time. And St. Augustine said it in the City of God, too. Where were these pagan gods? Now, you know, if you've been listening to me for a while, you know that the idea of God and gods is equivocal. The god, whether it be Zeus or you know, Thor, Perun, that they weren't actually thought to be real. And I have several articles on this. And Plato was the first one to really expose this in the ancient world, that they're archetypes. That's why the stories of these beings always changed. Something along the lines of what Superman would be in America. Why is Superman so popular in that crazy outfit? He represents something. He represents this strength in the service of justice. But simple people probably thought so. And where were they? You know, the people had regularly honored these beings, sacrifices, and everything else, only to be exterminated by force. I mean, you know, almost three-quarters of them, the remaining forcibly converted. There's no intervention. There's no strength in this. And we're talking about their supporters here. Neo-pagans claim that the Slavic gods had children rather than slaves. In front of your eyes, three-quarters of your children are killed, and a quarter forced to disown you. Wouldn't you interfere? Or wouldn't their followers interfere? So, whether or not you believe that these were real entities, you clearly are exposed as extremely weak, exactly what you think Christianity is. And I've said this before, they haven't figured out whether Christianity makes you a super warrior or makes you a weakling. And they go back and forth, kind of like Putin. Yeah, he's a communist and a fascist at the same time. Thinking that they're one and the same thing. So, given this mythology, what are the possible options here? Either that the Slavic gods wanted to help, but the Christian god turned out to be stronger and they couldn't do anything. I'm willing to believe that at a primitive level, this is what was thought at the time. People follow the religion of their leader because their leader was victorious. To this day, we have this primal revulsion about a nation who's defeated in warfare. It's not just the nation that's defeated, but the ideology that they promoted. The other option is that Slavic gods were strong and could help, but they didn't. I'm willing to say that's not in contradiction to the first one. And I also think that was part of the popular mind, the primitive mind at the time. Or, of course, that those gods didn't exist. And, of course, you can't expect any help from them. You notice all three of these options here are pretty much the same. Because if they refused to do anything, or if the Christian God was stronger, they might as well not exist. But given the biases at the time, this, you know, clashing of the Byzantine and Bulgarian idea on the one hand and native Slavs on the other, it probably went along the lines of Christ was simply more powerful. You see on my the graphic for this lecture, the picture that we used is the pulling down of the statue of Perun. Now, you had many saints do this, and nothing ever happened to them. There was attempts to martyr them, but you know, they're either, you know, some of them are killed for it, but for the most part, you had saints all over the place. You had saints in Britain, you had saints in Scandinavia, who were pulling down these statues, these groves, saying, well, let's see if your God is going to do anything about this. Again, it's a very crude understanding of God and gods. That's why you have no ultimate creator in paganism. When I say paganism, I'm talking about these native systems that developed all over the world according to natural law. You know, these gods are representative of different social functions. That's not an accident. So, but no matter what of those, which one of those options was real or true, or that people believed at the time, why would you ever go back to them? You can't have a handful of soldiers slaughtering almost the entire population because they didn't convert and believe that these gods were helpful at all. And yet, that's exactly the claim. Now, I happen to think that the neo-pagan movement doesn't believe them at all. They are symbols. They got, you know, maybe got their parents upset, and they think it's cool. That's pretty much as far as their mentality goes. But, of course, the entire thesis, when any kind of criticism is put to it, falls to pieces. Throughout Christian history, remember, violence is neutral. It's not good, it's not bad. It depends on its purpose of use, the target, the legal authority of those who do it, whether or not they're in consonance with natural law. Violence is not inherently bad. In many ways, especially in a dying society, most people are illogical, and that's really the only thing they understand. But the ridiculous assumption is that the state existed. When I talk about the state, I'm talking about the institutions of rule that exist today. You can't compare, of all places, 10th century Kiev and 21st century Britain or America. But because they're so ignorant and so emotional that they just assume it. But throughout Christian history, violence was always used. Destroying temples, pulling down sacred groves, stopping sacrifices, making fun of their idols, all that stuff. But the very fact that not only victorious rulers were supporting them, but nothing ever happened to them, this is what led people to convert. There was no possible way that this could have been done by force, given the nature of power at the time. Now, in the great ancient Russian story, epic really, the tale of bygone years, there is a story about how the idol of Perun was overthrown in Kiev, and the painting that we have for this show is based on that. So they took this rock statue and threw it into the Dnieper. And a few of the hardcore pagans, usually of the upper classes, you see this in Novgorod too, they were running along the shore. Yeah, they had ropes on it, and they're kind of pulling it, and they're yelling. They're saying, get out of there, get out of there. Actually talking to this stone thing, which, of course, was the, as they say, the last prayer to Perun on Russian soil. his last supporters, the hardcore that were left, they were yelling not to protect themselves from the Christian, according to this, but for Perun to protect himself, to not allow his degradation, pull themselves out of the water. You see, in the same the Old Testament story of Elijah and the prophets, this contest that they had, which, by the way, led to everyone but him being killed. If you perform this miracle, pull yourself out of this water, that's it. We don't have to worry about Christians anymore. And if that were to happen, of course, it's a very different story. Nothing happened. Even more, according to this story, when it was finally, you know, pushed out, there was one basically kind of part of it was on the shore, and a piece of it came washed up, and then a peasant went by and pushed it back into the river. And of course, in the tale of bygone years, this peasant was supposed to have said in Neo-Russian, Perun, you've eaten and drank your fill, now swim away. So not only was this deity, so-called, unable to protect his people, but even against one little peasant, he was powerless. And that, of course, is the point of the religious aspect of that story. These are the same gods that your neo-pagan today will draw up in like knights in armor. You know, they have muscles and they're throwing lightning bolts. Their very so-called theology certainly is not a peace-loving one. It was the theology of warrior bands. They didn't have any turn-the-other-cheek idea or to resist when you're crucified or something like that. No, quite the contrary. So you have built into their theology this master morality, Nietzschean idea. And yet they lost and was humiliated to the turn-the-other-cheek religion. And they couldn't help any of their supporters. Turn-the-other-cheek, of course, refers to the church itself. During missionary work, attack and counterattack will destroy the church. It has nothing to do with self-preservation or anything. You know, they didn't have to explain that at the time. It's not 21st century America. Obviously, it was common sense. Christ quoted the same prophets who killed people. Clearly, that wasn't an issue. So ultimately, even, you know, even if they're telling us to say this ridiculous story is true, either that the gods don't exist, they are inferior to the Christian God to such an extent that they tolerated humiliation, or they don't care about their followers. Remember, most of the disasters and violence in the world today, not only do they have a good side to them, but they're brought about by human beings. Here you have a direct relationship. They will defend you in times of trouble. They will intervene and stop, like, you know, all the stories have. Although the gods and the stories and the myths and the epics are just as selfish as anyone else. I mean, that's a projection. It's just the Superman version of themselves. I mean, Superman is not quite perfect. And with all this, somehow they want to return to a veneration of these gods. One side of their mouth, Christianity, the religion of weaklings. Other side of their mouth, they took over by force wherever they went. Those two things can't be true at the same time. But this is what I mean. Their critical faculties have been so atrophied. The very existence, living in 21st century America, will destroy your critical faculties. And they're not permitted to be used. That's what censorship is. And especially the mass censorship. You know, they'll permit the worst kind of violent pornography. Because that's what the First Amendment was meant to, you know, protect. But even the most moderate criticism of evolution is thrown off every social media site. I remember the first time I heard about this, it was Nature magazine. It was either Nature or Science. I know it was a one word, the big one. I think it was Nature. This is back when I was in college. They wouldn't publish anything that rejected the concept of evolution, which you would think it goes against their own mythology, them being open-minded and all that stuff, which of course they're not. But I realized, well, wait a minute, that you know, you have big name scientists who support creationism, IB and all the rest. They can't publish with you, no matter how solid the argument is. Well, just like censorship from the left today, it is because not only do they not know the argument, but they would rather not deal with it, and they don't have to. There's no the scientific mind can't simply reject evolutionism. Evolution, remember, was accepted as a projection of the British Empire in the rise of the great industrial conglomerates. That's why Darwinism was accepted. He was accepted, not that Darwin really wasn't a scientist anyway, but it was accepted without any evidence at all. At the time that those books were written, there was no direct, there was no, you know, no one knew what DNA was. It was accepted without evidence, and only later on they tried to build a case for it. And anything, because no one's going to call on it, especially in university or these kind of journals, no one's going to call them on it. They could simply ignore everything that goes against their theory and exaggerate everything that goes for it. All the frauds, you know, the Jesuits and all these groups, the frauds of, you know, I don't know, the Piltdown Man, I can't remember a lot of them. Now, none of these were real. They tried, and they were exposed. They were exposed by people like me. But the hatred, can you imagine the hatred and the irrationality where you know, Prince Vladimir is an equal to the apostles. That puts him at a level of sanctity of the actual apostles themselves. But the hatred, I think this visceral, demonic, you know, the opposite of grace, this demonic energy, has these people screaming and yelling that he somehow murdered 9 million people. As if there were those numbers existed in all of Russia at the time. You know, Father George and a whole bunch of others, they say how is this possible when, you know, Prince Igor, for example, was murdered just before the baptism, you know, a couple decades before the baptism of Russia, but was murdered because he wanted to increase taxes. Princes were killed even after Vladimir. Tremendous battles. And of course, St. Vladimir is really worried about the constant internecine war among cities and regions. That they'll do. But somehow these very same people would so easily allow themselves to be baptized by force. Even, you know, slaughtering people without any repercussions. Vladimir would have been murdered at the preparation stage. Unless, of course, there's more to the story. St. Vladimir realized that paganism was a dead end in the broad sense. Look at what happened to the peoples who maintained that system. The peoples of the, you know, the tribes of the Amazon, the natives of Australia, the Aborigines, the inhabitants of Black Africa. No written language, no culture, no statehood, no civilization. Islam and Orthodoxy at the time were highly literate. Literacy came with the missionaries. So in the famous story, in the chronicles of him choosing the true faith, the pagan idea was the last one he was going to worry about. And you notice how he chose here. He studied it himself. Then he sent ambassadors to study others. Then he consulted with them. And he called them all, and, you know, they gave their, in the course, in the chronicle, it's very truncated. I'm sure it was weeks and weeks of discussion. But only when there was some kind of a consensus, then was St. Vladimir baptized and called on the inhabitants of his kingdom to follow his example. Of course, those who didn't follow, which would be very rare given the circumstances, and even long after the death of Vladimir, they were still pagans and they were still being preached to. But, you know, and this, we're understanding where the story comes from. This fourth baptism of Russia, 9 million people, whatever the heck the number is. If it was a, you know, as typical of the Middle Ages, on the fringes of civilization, the Middle Ages, where, you know, people simply followed the religion of their rulers. That's what religion was. Anything other than forcible baptism, then it would sound ridiculous to say we need to return to the faith of our ancestors. Of course, the other question, I mean, you probably have figured this out already, but archaeology doesn't confirm any forced baptism of Russia, and this was during the Soviet era. Can you imagine trying to hide 9 million bodies? And they discovered in Britain several dozen Vikings without heads. In Rome, the skeletons of murdered babies, infanticide, pagan law, you know, had to abandon their parents put to death. And these things are constantly found here and there. Now, if there was a genocide of dissenters in the 10th century, then Russia would be overflowing with this stuff. But in the Soviet era, no matter how many ancient cities they dug up, nothing like this was ever discovered. Even though in the Soviet era, that would have been a great theory to come up with. They at least were honest enough to say, we can't find anything that justifies that silly point of view. Just like there's no concept of forcible baptism, which not only, given the time period, doesn't make any sense, but also would be immediately invalid. That's not the case with Islam, of course. That kind of initiation. But no, and of course people thought in terms of groups at the time. The individual didn't exist. When we talk about St. Vladimir, we're talking about a great man, of course, but we're talking about his whole administration, that 400 men. And he couldn't do much without a consensus there. So there's always committees and communities rather than actual isolated individuals. Now, there's there's an 18th century discovery. I forget the Joachim Chronicle that says that the voivode sent from Kiev to Novgorod met with the unwillingness of parts of the oligarchy there to be baptized and engaged in a rebellion against princely power. There was force, but only after the Novgorodians burnt his wife and children alive. Then the governor forced baptism on as a sign of defeat. They're well aware, of course, that forced baptism is nothing. It's just being, you know, dunked in water. But this violence actually came from this was simply the oligarchy. And I think the Novgorodian oligarchy never quite abandoned their support of materialism. Now, of course, the Joachim Chronicle, most people think it's a fake. No one has ever actually seen it, by the way. And if it did exist, it was compiled no earlier than the 17th century. But even if we were to believe this Joachim Chronicle, that no one's ever seen, it would suggest that the myth of St. Vladimir is incorrect. Because this fragment, this is how it ends. The quote is, "That is why people reproach the Novgorodians. He baptized with a sword and with fire." Well, how could the residents of other ancient Russian cities reproach him with this slogan if Russ was baptized by force? Why would that Novgorod idea be a big deal? If it happened everywhere, it wouldn't be anything worth talking about. It would be just simply assumed. That last line, that fragment, true or false, on the whole, then implies that the baptism of Russia took place peacefully. And Novgorod is an exception, which is why it's in there to begin with. And it's not, I've spoken about this before, Novgorod was a very pagan area because it was an oligarchy. And maintaining their hold on the tremendous wealth that they were able to have was bound up with paganism as they understood it. But this story, at least in Russia, is cited by atheists who will say that this was the norm. And they'll deliberately distort the text. Since this thing probably doesn't exist, they could attribute anything to it. Now, there is something else. About 60 to 70 years ago, Russian historical science only had three original texts at their disposal. And we've spoken about why. This is what Peter the Great did, destroying as many of the local histories as he possibly could. But I mean, about 60 years ago, there was a trove of birch bark letters, most of them from Novgorod, but also in, you know, every city there. There is more than 1,000 of them written on the other side of birch bark, which they use for writing. 450 were written in pre-Mongol times, and the earliest is first half of the 11th century. In other words, people who were still alive from the baptism. And it ends roughly the first half of the 13th century. Now, unlike chronicles, these birch bark letters were written by common people. These are kind of boring daily notes, personal correspondence. They're actually pretty boring to read. Censorship, of course, without a state is absolutely impossible. You could even talk about the state at the time as, you know, some administration over the nobility and the high-ranking churchmen. They didn't went no further than that. You couldn't censor the birch bark notes anyway. It was just day-to-day. No one, the state didn't reach into the day-to-day life of common people. And this is the real mentality of the peasantry and the townsmen at the time. Also suggests that literacy was far higher than they realized. I even have the site where you can go and read these. But now there are many texts on church topics, which shouldn't surprise you, but nothing negative and nothing specifically pagan. Now, this is a correspondence of ordinary people at the time, and no one is condemning what happened. No one is saying Perun is going to help you or Velez or anybody else. Someone's going to get punished by these people. And Soviet archaeologists also found these. And this is pretty much the final nail in the coffin at, that the baptism was done peacefully. Now, of course, you know, there is much in the ancient tradition, I don't call it a faith, because it's always changing. That's perfectly legitimate. You know, harvest festivals and certain form of burial. I mean, none of that is, you know, not always as the Pope said to St. Augustine of Canterbury, keep all that. Just the more fanciful theology may have to be corrected, but that's it. And I want to reiterate that terms like pagan or New Age or neo-pagan, these aren't exact terms. The heathen, for example, these are just anything that wasn't Christian or Islam or Judaic. So these aren't necessarily even theological at their root. But of all these birch bark notes, nothing referencing the gods, nothing referencing how evil the Christians were or anything like that. Not only did they throw out the old gods, but they didn't even remember them. And and there is not one thing about this in the birch bark. And that was a massive treasure trove unearthed in the Soviet era. But, you know, the baptism, as I wrote in my very first book, I wrote about in my essays on medieval Russia. How did it come about? I mean, in 866, Patriarch Phocius the Great sent a bishop to the Russians, who then baptized Prince Ascolt, and at least a part of the people, part of his soldiery. Not everyone, of course. Now, by the first half of the 10th century, you had a church of the prophet Elijah in Kiev, actually mentioned by the Greco-Russian Treaty of 944. And of course, people forget, 957, on her own initiative, the great St. Olga, one of the great female leaders of all time, was baptized. And then, of course, what she did contributed to the spread of Christianity in Russia. New churches and clergy appeared all over the place, especially in the cities. Now, the Western Rite, as some of you may remember, did have a presence there. The martyr bishop Adalbert, who was murdered by the Czech pagans on his way back to Germany. Olga brought the Western Rite in. He was invited by Olga, and he eventually had to, you know, he was unsuccessful. And he was unsuccessful not theologically, but because the Western way of thinking had clashed with what was already there. Adalbert was a saint, there's no question about it, a friend of Olga's. But he built a church, a Western Rite church in Kiev, that remained, of course. The archaeology is pretty much on our side here. And Vladimir, from the middle of the 10th century, the era of St. Vladimir, pictorial crosses are found in the burials of the nobility. But Christianity was accepted, Orthodoxy was accepted, because it was a voluntary choice. It was a peaceful, I shouldn't even say choice, it was a peacefully accomplished goal that the church, again associated with St. Olga, who was always a heroine, was there for 120 years before all of this happened. For example, one of the councils that Vladimir hosted on the issue of theology, one of the boyars said, if the Greek law was so bad, then your grandmother Olga would not have accepted baptism. But she, in fact, was the wisest of all people. So it's simply not the concept is non-tenable, not to mention humiliates the very nature and history of Russians. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the great St. Hilarion, Metropolitan of Kiev, who was only there a few years, died in 1054 of all years. And his Sermon on Law and Grace is one of the greatest early manifestations of Slavic Russian literature. And it's something, it's actually a philosophy of history, and it's become one of the classics of ancient literature, no matter where you go. I should say medieval literature. There, of course, he's talking about the Jews for the most part. The Khazar Empire was, what did St. Vladimir have? He had Khazar Jews, Islam, of course, the Westerners, and the Byzantine / mostly Bulgarian faith by that point, but the Byzantine Bulgarian faith. Now, St. Hilarion does mention the flattery of idols, but he spends most of his time talking about the Khazar Jews. When you say Jew, you meant Khazar at the time, of course, and still used as an epithet for them there. So they understood it firsthand. Now, the one thing that all of those groups that I mentioned have in common is that they were all quite literate. But the Khazar yoke was seen as so horrible and destructive and draining the wealth and manpower of Russia. Now, that is, there's no question about that. There was no chance of that being adopted. The world would be a very different place if that was the case. But Jew Khazar meant the same thing. Now, in this work, Hilarion uses the phrase, the law of the lake dried up, the gospel source was flooded. Here we are, Christians glorifying the Trinity, but Judea is silent. Christ is glorified, Jews are cursed. The nations are brought in, the Jews rejected. Now, the law of the lake refers to the Khazar slave trade. Khazaria was a non-productive society. It was Jewish, at least at the upper levels. It was, your proto-Talmud kind of mentality. It was seen as really an ethnic marker more than anything else. And the tribute that they charged on shipping down the Volga was massive, and it impoverished the country. The law of the lake is the law of this rent-seeking, usurious mentality that you found in Khazaria. It's very rare that anyone mentions the law of the lake here, or the law of the sea. And he's not just referring to Khazaria, he's mostly referring to them, but he also is referring to your mercantile idea in general. Again, he notes the fact that the problem is with these Jews is that without cohesiveness, they have nothing, because they're always so small in number The only way that they could dominate is through constant deception. I remember Rabbi David Weiss, who's an old friend of mine, Notori Card, I used to tell me. He said the problem with Zionism is that because there's only a handful of Jews in every country, they have to use secretive means to take over and subvert governments. That's right in their introductory literature. And it's the same thing. That's why they go after the media, the universities, law. You know, they're not trying to take over, you know, garbage routes or anything like that. But that the whole world was opened up here. Now, he certainly believed in nations. He was a nationalist. He talks about the historical role that Russia plays just at its very inception. So it is prophecy in the legitimate sense. Nations are real. In the Jewish mind, there's only one nation that's real, which is where so much cosmopolitanism comes from. And it's very rare to find a neo-pagan that's not a cosmopolitan, which, of course, is very foreign to them at the time. He says, "For the grace-filled faith has spread throughout the land and has reached our Russian people." St. Vladimir connects St. Vladimir with Emperor Constantine the Great and Russian princes, most in general. He says, "Who by the reign, by courage and bravery, known in many countries, and now commemorated and glorified with victories and strength. For your dominion is not a thin and unknown land, or a minor and unknown land, but Russia, which is known and heard in all four corners of the earth." And of course, monasticism, he was one of the laying the foundation of the caves, while still a simple priest in Beretsovo. So the question of, you know, Islam, Judaism were connected. Islam, of course, you couldn't drink. And they were usually opponents most of the time. Western Catholicism was simply too dry and were very foreign, even though that Olga had invited Adalbert in. But, I mean, all Western Rite Orthodox, you probably have an icon of St. Adalbert somewhere. So the Byzantine / Bulgarian faith accepted by Olga was all that remained. And these were connected with large civilizations, victorious armies, and literacy, high literature, what we would call high culture today. When St. Vladimir converted, he had, I forget the number, always changed, it's like 800 wives. The word wife is probably an exaggeration. These were something like the terem. I'll talk about the concept of the harem, which is mostly a figment of the debased British aristocracy's imagination in the 18th and 19th century. It was not a sexualized thing at all. It was a whole civilization, in fact. And, of course, that was all removed. You know, fasting, everything else, which is, he thought what he needed. And we know that he was genuine because he followed it very strictly. He had one wife, he kept the fast, and he realized that as Orthodoxy unified the Byzantine and Bulgarian empires, it will unify his as well. And the problem with paganism is that no centralization is possible, no matter how, you know, when you claim that there's different gods and there's no overall creator god, they're just super people. But when you have a creator, creation from nothing was a bizarre concept at the time, because the concept of nothing, to a great extent, didn't exist. The numeral for zero was imported largely from India, which makes sense. The concept of nothing, the concept of empty space, didn't exist. You had no consist. So the idea of creation from nothing was considered a bizarre innovation. They couldn't wrap their head around it. But that's what makes Yahweh different than everybody else. And this is a first and only. I mean, you know, people think that you have creator gods in Egypt. No, they're architects. Ptah and everyone else, they worked with what was already there. No, God is a creator of spirit and matter, and their interrelation. So it's extremely important to know exactly, this was the mentality. The Sermon of Law and Grace was the mentality of Russia at the time. He had huge audiences. Of course, he was canonized, and it became a standard in Russian literature. The Jews were out. Muslims were out. The West was out. All that was left are those closest to them. And I think it's St. Olga's example, more than anything else, that guaranteed a peaceful transition. She was a heroine in the Russian land, universally revered. Paganism just meant constant warfare among these warrior bands, which meant that the society could never have developed. He noticed how these pagan societies all over the world never really progressed. And yet the what existed at the time, but the so-called monotheistic religions created civilization. And he didn't see a single pagan society at the time that had any real standing in anything that he was dealing with at all. Olga guaranteed a complete peaceful conversion of Russia. And don't let the idiots ruin your day. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.